Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Wajaha Ali has been many things, including a columnist for the Daily Beast and the New York Times, a public speaker, a playwright, even an attorney. He's also a husband, the dad of three kids, and the son of Pakistani immigrants. In his new memoir, Ali explores all those identities, as well as others that have been imposed on him, including both us and them. In his book, Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on How to Become American, Ali traces his life from childhood as a shy, left-handed kid in Fremont, California, who liked to tell stories and spoke Urdu until the age of five, through his college years, when the reaction to 9/11 led him to become, as he puts it, quote, an accidental activist. Ali also recalls personal and familial hardships, life-changing events, such as both of his parents being swept up in a massive anti-piracy sweep and arrested by the FBI, or when his daughter was diagnosed with stage 4 liver cancer at just 3 years old. The book also discusses the history of immigration in the country, the distortion of the pursuit of the American dream, and he handles all these big subjects and experiences with thoughtful commentary and lots of humor. Tonight, he'll be at Symphony Space for an evening of storytelling, music, and comedy with guests including Preet Bharara and Aparna Charla. Wajaha Ali, welcome to the show.
Allison Stewart, I'm on with you. I have made it in America. My immigrant parents are happy. They said, well, how come you didn't become a doctor? You became a writer, and look at me now. I'm on WNYC with you. I made it.
You made it. You probably have a tote bag. They're really happy.
If I could get a tote bag and a coffee mug, I'm going to show that to my relatives in Pakistan. They're like, I don't have a medical degree, but damn it, I got a WNYC tote bag.
It's all on the canvas. So in the first, the very beginning of the book, you start with hate mail. Many of these I can't read on the radio because of FCC regulations. Some of the ones I can are fan mail number 3. You're a real smart ass, Gandhi. You have a very good response to that one. Your people have accomplished nothing. There's the one that gave you the book's title. There's also, I saw you agitating for a race war against white people, European descended people. What are you waiting for, little man? And for each of these, you write these responses, and some of them are very, very funny. Why did you feel like this was the right place to start?
You know, I felt like you want to do a gut punch, right? This is how it feels like to be an American, a Mitch McConnell's hyphenated American with the asterisks, right? The otherized American, where there's our citizenship is conditional. We're told almost daily, you don't belong. And so every day, even though I was born and raised in this country, even though I am a citizen, even though I have all the legal rights, I'm told, go back to where you come from. Go F a goat or a camel. And I'm trying to figure out why only goats and camels? There's a huge animal kingdom, but I digress. And so how do you respond? You can respond with pain and you can cry, but I want to be like Daffy Duck. Daffy Duck is always hunted by Yosemite Sam and Elmer Fudd, right? But Daffy Duck uses their traps against them. So humor, if used strategically and with intention, can booby trap the hate and turn, if you will, the weapon against the oppressor. And kind of, I think humor, specifically how I open this book, also shows you the ridiculousness and the stupidity of bigotry and hate. And it's a way of I try to sweeten the medicine on this bumpy journey, both of life, of being the other American, and this book, which is filled with joy and pain.
How did you get there? Because I think for anybody who's been in the public eye for a while, you get used to it. Mm. But those first couple,
They hit you hard.
Yeah.
You know, I was a fat kid and I developed tough skin because I was fat in the 1980s when there was only two types of folks, normal kids and fat kids. And every day was World War III for the fat kid. And I used to wear Husky pants. There was no Lizzo. There was no Dove soap commercial, right? There was nothing but body positivity. If you wore Husky pants, I'm sorry for triggering you if you're listening, tough skins and Husky pants. Even the kid who used to eat paste used to make fun of us, right? So you develop trauma and scars, but you also develop tough skin. And the way we respond, I think, to pain is, you know, I was just lucky. I responded with humor. I couldn't outrun my oppressors and bullies, but I could be smarter than them. I could be faster than them. I could be wittier than them. And so that was type of a muscle I honed, and the muscle of storytelling, improv comedy, sketch comedy, And then I just realized I'd bring this to my public life as a Muslim brown person. If you're a woman or a person of color, you're in the social media space, every day you get hate. It's just how it is. And so some people shut down, and I have a lot of brilliant friends who said, I can't do this anymore. And I understand, because they don't want to take the pain. But I said, I'm not going to have my voice silenced by haters. I'm going to hit back, and I'll hit back with a smile. And like Bugs Bunny, I'm going to make sure I eat the carrot at the end of the skit.
You've written plays about your life experience. You're a public speaker, all the various kind of talks, Aspeny, Teddy's, all of them. What was different about writing the memoir?
The memoir, you have to bear yourself completely. In order to be truly authentic and honest, in order to connect with the audience, the reader, in order to have a relationship, I think the reader can smell a fraud. And so you have to tell it all, the good, the bad, the ugly, the pain, the warts. You have to unlock and unleash the trauma, the T word, which it was painful for me to even admit, because I've been through things in life. I've had an eventful life, if you read the book. And I think when my father and my wife, I married way up, by the way, way, way up. She said, you know, you actually have trauma. And I'm like, how dare you say that? I don't have trauma. I'm a privileged person. And trauma is only for those folks who've really suffered. She goes, no, you've gone through a lot. And I think to excavate that and share it, you have to do it with honesty. That's the only way to tell the story. You have to tell the joy and the pain and the sadness and the tears. And that, I think, is the American life for the rest of us. It's the American dream and the American nightmare. And if you don't tell that story, you're not telling the true story of America. And it's a microcosm of what's happening in this country. Some people want the sanitized, literally whitewashed version of America that does not make them feel uncomfortable. In order to really connect with people, I'm okay with people feeling a bit discomfort. In order to get there, you got to talk about these painful issues.
My guest is Wajaha Ali. The name of the book is Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on How to Become American. Yeah, I was really, you're reading along, and the book takes a turn that I didn't expect. I didn't know your parents' story. I didn't know about your parents being swept up in this raid for fraud, and then they had made a bad decision. They'd taken some bad advice and had their names changed at one point and social security numbers. So it all just got very murky. I won't give away too much, but you end up busted broke. And trying down to $20
3 cents. Wait, Allison, I wasn't a scrub. I had $20.03.
And you, I was curious in that moment, what did you think that the future was going to be? You were still kind of a kid when that happened.
I was 21. I had to leave school and take care of my grandparents. I was an only child. My parents got swept up. I had to find money to pay for the lawyers, take care of the office, take care of the bills. And I was surgical with my Excel sheet. And one time I went to Wells Fargo at the corner of Mission and Warm Springs in Fremont, California. And I thought I would take out $20 and I would have $70 left. I got the receipt. It was 0.03. That's all I had left in $20. And I sat there staring at the receipt, and all I could do was laugh. I just started laughing. And I think people thought I was kind of crazy, but all you can do is chuckle. I'm like, what do you do with 3 cents? So instead, I went to Subway and had a supersized meal, a foot-long tuna with all the works and two chocolate chip cookies. And I went next door to Starbucks. I had a venti caramel frappe with extra caramel drizzle. I was reduced to $10.03. I went home to my grandmother's. I said, I have done everything in my power and we're reduced to 3 cents. There's nothing else I can do. And I remember, Allison, this was fascinating. I had the most beautiful, comforting sleep I've ever had in my life that night. And I've tried to recreate that sleep because I exhausted myself completely. And then, like so many people listening right now who are flattened by the pandemic, I'm like, I've done everything I can. And then I just felt like God, universe, I did everything I could. I release it to you. And in a strange way, by letting go, I felt free. And the next day, somehow magically, I got an infusion of $2,500. The page turned. The story wasn't over. And I kept going. And I thought, maybe, just maybe, inshallah, God willing, there will be a plot twist. And that's how I lived about 10 years of my life. That inshallah, the next page will bring a plot twist.
When have you had to go back to that moment to go forward?
Gosh, my daughter's cancer, the last 3 years, you know, my daughter 3 years ago, 8 months before the pandemic, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and in need of a full liver transplant. And in a strange way, you know, people say whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Yeah, but it leaves scars. It leaves trauma. It leaves pain. But it also creates a muscle memory. And I remember I said, I've been through much worse. I've been through this. I can take it. And you know what? There were these moments where I was at the edge of the cliff, and the cliff was falling. And I decided to take out a lawn chair and admire the scenery. And so live in this moment. I don't know what's going to happen. The doctors have said she might not survive. But you know what? Just maybe, inshallah, the page will turn and the story will bring with it some better news. And I remember I used to sit there at night after my kids used to fall asleep and my wife fell asleep, like Doctor Strange in Avengers Infinity War with the time stone. I used to imagine 500 mm-hmm. scenarios because I'm a father. And I imagined burying my daughter. I imagined calling my parents mm-hmm. with the terrible news because I had to prepare myself. But then I also imagined her magically getting a liver transplant and living her life and wearing her princess dresses. And I chose to invest in that story of hope. And that's sometimes all we have. It's all we need is hope. And lo and behold, an anonymous donor stepped up. She got a full liver transplant. She rang the bell. She's cancer-free. She's 5 years old. And she has told me I need to get her an Encanto dress from New York from the Disney store when I come back home.
How many times do you play the song, Bruno?
We talk about Bruno freaking 57 times, all right? Bruno needs to effing go, all right? Bruno, I'm done with you. Like, literally, I was on MSNBC mm-hmm. last night, and I'm like, hey, you guys want to watch me? Your Baba on MSNBC? They're like, no, we're watching Encanto. And I could hear Bruno's song while I was live on air, and my three kids gave zero Fs that their only Baba, their loving Baba, was on TV. They're like, no, we choose Bruno.
My guest is Wajaha Ali. The name of the book is Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on How to Become American. So as we learn all this personal stuff about you and your family and we get invested in your life story, you're also, you know, you telescope out and you talk about what it's like to be othered for all the people who are reading this, who have been othered in their lives. When you're thinking about telling that story, the story of what it's like to be othered, when you've read it other places, what hasn't rung true that you wanted to get to?
What hasn't rung true is the specifics. The universal is oftentimes found in the specifics. And many people who have read this book, people of different ethnicities, they're like, I found so many entryways through your specific story. You being an ESL, your name, you wanting to change your name, you wearing your shoes in your home, your religious eccentricities, the fact that your mom put green stuff in the kebabs, the fact that your parents, you know, lived with your older parents because you don't put your seniors in the home. Mm-hmm. It's oftentimes when we are othered, we are told that you have to become mainstream. You have to adapt your story and neuter it for the people. And that means flattening yourself, taking away the richness, the merch, the masala, everything that makes you you, get rid of it. You have curly hair, straighten it. You have a flat nose, make it thin. You have brown skin, make it white. You're Muslim, hide it. Be mainstream, be white, and whiteness will never accept you. Even when you get rid of everything, the merch and the masala to fit in, you're still not accepted. You're still told to go back to where you came from. You're still told by the president, why do these people come from S-hole countries? And it's never worth it. So instead, I tell people, invest in the merch and the masala and the specifics. Go all in. I ignored the advice that was given to me 13, 14 years ago that your very ethnic story will not relate to the mainstream. Translation, hey, darky, make it applicable for white people. And then once you make it specific, you realize that's when the audience believes you because it's authentic and it's real. And if you tell a good story, it doesn't matter. An audience shows up. Squid Games, number one show on Netflix in Korean. People don't care. Tell a good story, you'll get an audience.
You know, you and I, although you're younger than I am, you are generation-ish.
I look older than you, so congratulations.
Our generation-ish, we're lucky that we can feel this way. And you write about your parents' generation and how they were really sold something else. And they believed it. They were sold it, and they bought it, and they wrapped it up and took it home. I'm going to read a little bit from your book.
Please.
Once upon a time when we thought we were white and moderate. Many Muslims from my father's generation who came to this country after the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act chased whiteness, which was part and parcel of the American gene. They will deny it if you ask them because they will say they came here just to make a better life for themselves and their families. In fact, I bet all my limited money that they will be unable to articulate or even define whiteness. But whiteness they chased nonetheless, even though they knew they would never fully grasp it or be accepted in its privileged country clubs or walk through its gilded doors to executive boardrooms or be elected to its political positions or read its scripts as the protagonists of a TV drama or receive its blessings when they asked for Susie's hand in marriage. Still, it was enough to be adjacent to its acceptance, to be asymptomatic to its power, to retreat into its warmth, protective embrace, preferably in a safe, good, gated suburban community. They were like Icarus, who thought their wings made of money, wax, and upward social mobility would let them escape their brownness, their Muslim-iness, their accented English, their multisyllabic names, their turmeric-infused fingernails. Why do you think that generation believed it?
They were sold the American dream, the myth, and they believed it. They bought into it, that if I come here and bootstrap myself and do everything right, then I too can be American. I won't be the white protagonist, but I could be the goofy sidekick. And I could live in the suburban communities and they'll accept me with my white teeth smiling, and I'll be politically neutered, and I'll work hard, and I'll get good credit, and I'll buy a Toyota, and my kids will go to a good school, and they're married a good wife, and they'll have good families. And I won't be like the bad Americans, because they came here and they saw the scene. And the scene they saw was, who's the hero? White. Who does America hate? Black and poor brown folks. Who am I going to chase towards and run towards? White. Who am I going to run away from? Blacks and browns. And then maybe they'll embrace me. And then this country, like it has always done, on the turn of a dime, turns on the other Americans. For many Muslims, immigrants, South Asians, and Arabs, it was war and terror. For those who weren't paying attention, it was the election of Donald Trump. It was the Chinese Americans in 1882. It was the Japanese Americans in World War II. It's always been black folks and Mexicans and indigenous Americans. And now in the past year, Asian Americans who were being blamed for a coronavirus, which has no ethnicity or zip code. The rude awakening, the baptism by fire, that you will never be American enough because you are the right, you're the wrong complexion. And the only way to become American is to lock hands with those of us who are still trying to be the co-protagonists, be intersectional, and expand and stretch this country to include the rest of us. It was a very painful awakening. And that awakening is still happening, by the way, Allison.
You know, you write a bit about post 9/11, and it reminded me of a segment we did about having to be the model minority. And we had a professor on, and I'm blanking her name at the moment, and she developed a Bechdel test for Muslim actors, that can you have a movie where a Muslim is not hyper patriotic at this point? Like, you have to be super patriotic. You have to be either super apologetic. This idea that you just can't be. Do you see any progress in that area in the past? Let's say, we'll say 20 years, right?
Yes, it's been pretty remarkable. What I call it is the national security narrative. Our only validity, our only usefulness is whether or not we are fighting ISIS or Al-Qaeda, right? That's it. So you're the good Muslim if you're part of the FBI and law enforcement, and you're a bad Muslim if you're pretty much everyone else. And if you don't loudly and violently and quickly condemn violent actions done by violent actors you've never met, then your loyalty and patriotism is held as suspect forever, and you're convicted and sentenced by a nameless judge during executioner. And even when you do condemn, you haven't condemned fast enough. You haven't condemned hard enough. And even when you do condemn, you're the unicorn. How come others aren't condemning? It's an endless game, Allison, where you always lose. It's like what Toni Morrison said, right? You always have to prove your civilizational worth to a skeptical audience, and then you waste your life. And you're like, no matter what I do, they don't believe me. But now, fast forward 20 years, maybe due to the sum of the work that my old generation did, you see people like Hasan Minhaj. You see people like Riz Ahmed. You see Miss Marvel as part of the Avengers. They're just talented individuals who happen to be Muslim and American. They're able to flex their Musliminess when they want to, but other times they could just talk about their shoes and sneakers and their life. And that's the arc, right? The arc of becoming American is, first and foremost, you're the villain, you're the stereotype. You are essentialized by that one character trait that makes you the bad guy. Then you become the goofy sidekick, the punchline, right? You're still allowed to come to the party, but they laugh at you. You never get the girl. You're never the A storyline. And then the third part is when you are the co-protagonist of the narrative and you are a multidimensional character who just happens to be Muslim. We still have a ways to go. There was a president who did a Muslim ban. There was literally Lauren Boebert, who had open Islamophobia and was condoned by her party. And now one of the major political parties openly traffics in Islamophobia, to the point where if George W. Bush, one of the worst presidents that I thought would ever come through, ran for president in 2024, his own party would say he's a Muslim lover and reject him. So it's good and bad.
Tonight at Symphony Space, this is such an interesting event. You've got comedian Aparna Chawla, former Southern District Attorney Preet Bharara, Zishan B, the musician. It's not your typical book event, it sounds like. What inspired the format for this event tonight?
When I did my play and published my play 10 years ago, I hated this traditional book format, just boring, of a writer going there and reading his book. Instead, everywhere I went, I wanted to do a multicultural talent show. I called it an extravaganza. So today we have Wajahat Ali and Super Friends. And I don't want to be selfish. I want to create a block party, which is delicious. So we got Minjin Lee, we got Kathy Park Hong, we got Preet Bharara, we got stand-up comedians, we got music, we got readings. And it's at Symphony Space, and you got to be vaxxed and masked. And I was shocked. I thought maybe we'd get 30 people. It seems like we might sell out. So why just focus it on me? Let's use the book and the themes to celebrate all these narratives and all these talented folks, and let's have a block party.
What's been the most surprising reaction to your book? One, you said, I did not see that coming.
Two surprising, consistent reactions. Number one, people did not expect to laugh so much. And number two, people said, I did not expect this book to end on such a hopeful note. And I did not know I needed that hope right now. And that makes me very happy. I hope that the book has what I called an earned hope, not a Hollywood ending, not a saccharine Hallmark, you know, cliched ribbon at the end. The earned hope is you go through the gauntlet, you go through the forest of horrors, you wear the scars and the pain, but you still come out with a smile at the end, and you still say, inshallah, things can be better. A type of pragmatic, world-weary hope that I think people need right now, that I think people really need to invest in. And the fact that people have responded to that hopefulness in the book, I was very pleasantly surprised.
The name of the book is Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on How to Become American. My guest has been Wajahat Ali. Thank you for making time today.
Thank you, Allison.
They're trying to get you a tote bag. I see it in the Slack.
And I need a coffee mug, too.
Hey, pipe down. Take a bag. Move on.
Got to stretch that dollar.
Take a bag and move on.